Well, a lot of folks don't know that the Black Panther Party had a position in solidarity with the Palestinians in 1968. We had wrote a position in the Panther newspaper, and the headline was Zionism plus racism equals genocide. And it was in full support of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. It presented an analysis of the occupied territories, how they became occupied. And we had sent a delegation to Beirut. We had working relationships with the PFLP under Dr. George Habash. We had a working relationship with the PLO. And and of course, this led to FBI and CIA machinations, by the way. They launched a whole campaign and, that was designed to divide the Black Panther Party from its, quote, liberal Jewish support. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the details of the counterintelligence program. Well, you know, I have over 600,000 pages or something like that, some crazy figures of COINTELPRO documents. And one of the things that stands out in these documents, that runs through this whole counterintelligence and domestic surveillance in the United States, is the fear that the establishment has of liberal Jews supporting of civil rights. This is something that J. Edgar Hoover was obsessed with in terms of Dr. King, in terms of civil rights movement. He became completely insane when it came to the Black Panther Party around this type of support. And one of the programs that the government launched was a program called it was a disinformation program, but they had a very racist name for it. And it involved the support of Jewish liberals for the Black Panther Party. And one of the outstanding examples, of course, was the Leonard Bernstein incident. I'm quite sure many of you who have read the COINTELPRO papers, who have read things around suppression of the Black movement, they were very, very keen on separating Black activism from white liberal support. And they saw Jewish liberals as being especially sympathetic, given the history of Jewish people in Europe, given the history of anti-Semitism in the United States and in Western societies. Of course, we know that many of the early activists in American working class history were Jewish organizers, Jewish activists. We know that the greatest opposition to the rise of fascism and Nazism in Germany and in Europe were from Jews. Of course, there's a flip side to that. I don't want to get into that right now, but I'm trying to say that the federal government understood this, and they carried out a program to acerbate this particular contradiction. And this program involved forging letters sent to prominent Jewish philanthropists saying that the Black Panther Party were anti-Semitic, we supported Nazism, we were fat black fascists, that the Black Panther Party was racist, and it was anti-Israeli, and all of these things. And this was designed to cut off support for the Black Panther Party, and of course, this all came to light when I got my counterintelligence files from my lawsuit, and the Bernstein case was prominent in these documents. Leonard Bernstein, some of you may be too young to remember this, some of you, I think quite a few of you are old enough to remember, was an internationally renowned composer and leader of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, I believe. And he was a very prominent fellow in Western culture. And you know that the leader of this particular orchestra is very well known. And he hosted, in 1969, he hosted a fundraiser for the Black Panther Party in New York 21. And the FBI used this fundraiser, first of all, to underwrite and support and encourage the writings of, what's this gentleman's name, the guy who dresses all dapper. I can't remember these characters, man. They're all enshrined. I'm 65 years old, so they're all enshrined now. They're street names. And, you know, so here I walk by the names of streets named after my tormentors, you know. And now they have statues of them in the park, pigeon poop on it, and all of this stuff. But this guy wrote this book,
Bonfire of Vanities,
and the other one,
Radical Chic
was the article in the New York Magazine. He wrote Radical Chic, and this was supposed to, and you know, the FBI was ecstatic with this article. If you read the reports about, they were ecstatic that this guy wrote this article, because they felt it was a very effective propaganda piece for liberal Jews who do. It's a wake-up call, you know, these guys are thugs, they're murderers, they're killers, and all of these things. And I undoubtedly probably did have some thugs, murderers, and killers somewhere in the Black Panther Party. I mean, you got thugs, murderers, and killers in the U.S. government. So I'm quite sure Obama can't account for every thug, murderer, and killer in the U.S. government. So we couldn't account for everyone that might have been in the Black Panther Party. But he wrote this book, and the whole idea was to scare Jewish support. And now we're witnessing the same thing now with Islamophobia. We're looking at the same thing now. You know, I wrote a paper that was to be delivered. I think I sent it to you, didn't I? I had wrote an outline, because, you know, our Palestinian comrades and a lot of folks who have immigrated to the United States are not really familiar with the repressive history of the United States, which is one of the reasons why perhaps the late Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, is such a valuable tome. Because it opened up the eyes of a lot of folks, you know, to what America, its real history is about, you know. And the ability of counterintelligence programs to force a wedge between white left liberal support of a radical black nationalist organization was a historical lesson that we should really learn, you know. I know from talking to folks here that there's cases right now pending in the court with grand juries right here in Minneapolis. And grand jury, of course, is being used as an instrument for political repression. It's used as an instrument to probe into organizations. It's used as an instrument of coercion and intimidation. And this has been the history of the grand jury since the 50s, since the McCarthy era. So we're not looking at really anything new when we're looking at this Patriot Act. And this is my point, because a lot of us think that this Patriot Act represents something that's new. Yes, new. It's a new and improved version, because of course we're living in a different time, you know, where this is not the McCarthy era. You know, Muslims are not, quote, communists. Okay. This is not pre-World War I, pre-World War II, or even immediate post-World War II. This is the 21st century. This is at a point in history where U.S. democracy has developed into a form of democratic fascism. And this may seem as a contradiction in terms. I mean, a lot of us who have come up in the left and have used these terms, communists and socialists and fascists, we all have these strict definitions of what fascism is and what communism is and what socialism is and what capitalism is. But what we fail to realize is that the United States is a unique form of empire that has evolved out of its own history. There is no other historical development of a nation state that compared to the United States. mean, just think about it. Let's go back and revisit, each of you, if you will, how it ends people's history in the United States. Just go back and revisit it for a minute. And you'll see that the development of the U.S. as a republic, as a political entity, as a cultural entity, has occurred inside of a historical moment that is unlike any historical moment that's ever occurred in modern civilization. France didn't have this. We know the development of France from the Frankish clans, and we know the development of England from the Angles and the Saxons and the Teutons. All of these particular historical developments we know about. We know about the legacy of Rome in Europe, but what do we know about the development of the United States as an entity, or what as an embassy, as an entity that brought forward Western civilization to where it's at today? What do we know about it? You go out into the street here in Minneapolis, and this is a college town in many respects, and ask the average kid on the street, you know, to locate three countries. Just say Cambodia, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Just ask them to locate, where are these countries at? You know, well, what's the population? Just in general. And you'll find, you'll be surprised at the answers you get. There's this abysmal amount of ignorance that passes for education in the school system. And this is important to understand because the United States is first and foremost an empire in denial. The denial part is only possible with miseducation of the population. So we actually have people sit on television and debate whether the United States is an empire or not. I mean, that's a given. What is there to talk about? You see? I mean, what is there to talk about? And if we look at how the issues are framed, whether they're the issues of human rights, whether they're the issues of environment, whether they're the issues of technology, whether they're the issues of immigration, look at these issues in their context, in their historical context, and you would see that there is a direct evolutionary chain of events from, I would venture to say, and I'm just cutting it off here for convenience sake, from 1945, from the end of World War II, up until this moment. Everything that we're going through right now in this moment in this country is a consequence of the end of that conflict. That's what it's about. Now, there's other issues in which we all know that particular conflict, the basis for that was set in the First World War. I'm just cutting it off in 1945 because we can't get too ancient with a lot of young folks here. Because it's like, hey man, that's like ancient history. Wasn't that when Caesar was around or something? You know, and so you can't do that with young folks. And we have some young folks here. We gotta try to keep it jiggy. Try to keep the mind. Try to keep the flow going. So we're gonna cut it off in 1945 when I was 1 year old. So if I'm standing here, it can't be that ancient. Okay? So we're gonna cut it off there. But the reason why I wanna say that is because when we look at the roots of the conflict in the Middle East, it's from there. It's from World War I, it's from the Balfour Agreement, it's from the occupation of Palestinian territory, it's from the whole phenomena of empires at the end of the century in Europe, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. I mean, we do know. And these are facts. And this is something that is very difficult to really get across to progressive people who feel uncomfortable about Zionism. And that is that the state of Israel and the whole context, the geopolitical context that we call the Middle East, which is something else altogether, that the state of Israel is a European settler state. It's a European settler state, pure and simple. Whatever ideology it uses to justify that, whatever nationalism it uses to justify that, does not take away that dialectic and that dynamic. It's a European settler state. Now, if it's a European settler state, you know, we know that settler states have certain things, certain characteristics about them. And all these characteristics fit the profile of the Zionist state of Israel. It's racist and apartheid. It's elites come from outside of the territory and have no connection whatsoever to the land. It has it's an expansionist in nature. It's reactionary in its international and diplomatic politics. It allies itself with some of the most reactionary forces on the planet. We got to remember that Israel had an alliance with South Africa. Apartheid South Africa.
Yeah.
And it was conducting nuclear tests with South Africa. There's many of us in here remember all of this. A lot of young folks don't know this, but there's plenty of us in here I can see who remember all of this, who remember during the anti-apartheid struggle and how we had to boycott the Israeli embassies and get them to withdraw their support from South Africa. What was the U.S. position on South Africa then? Constructive engagement. Remember? The U.S. position was, well, we can't boycott South Africa because we're going to hurt the people. What we have to do is constructively engage the government to change its policies against the black majority. Constructive engagement. That was the policy of the United States government. Constructive engagement. And what is the policy now towards the Middle East? Constructive engagement. It's the same policy. They talk about a peace process, the quartet. I mean, do you think people over there singing or something? You know, are they singing doo-wops? Old style tunes? Are we listening to the flamingos and, you know, and stuff like that? Or are they all singing, what's that guy from AC/DC? Or, you know, that crew, you know, the guy with the devil stuff on, you know. I mean, what's the quartet? Absolutely. I mean, the American public is absolutely confused. Just look at this. We look at the economy. I mean, now the economy belongs to Obama. But how many of us watched the moment that Obama was about to ascend to the presidency, Bush comes out and declares that the country's bankrupt? The same month. And then the Republicans, in less than 2 weeks, are claiming on how Obama is the one who brought the economy. I mean, we just go from one absurdity to the next, which tells you that the empire is in trouble. It's in trouble. Whenever a nation state, a republic, a system that relied on white supremacy through its entire history, through changing the complexion, the characteristics of white supremacy, for over 200 years elects a black man as president, that should tell you something. Now, of course, it told some black folks that meant that America has reached the point where race no longer matters. I mean, we don't even have to argue that on an emotional basis. We just could argue that on a factual basis, because every statistic that shows the social, economic, and political well-being of ethnic groups in the United States is fraught with the overemphasis of negativity on black folks. I mean, when we look at employment, if it's 10%, 12% in the white community, it's like 37% in the black community. And you got to remember, when they talk about double the unemployment rate, they're only talking about people who apply for unemployment. You know, you got black folks in the black community who stopped looking for jobs 5 or 6 years ago. You know, they're in the other economy. You know that other economy that we transact business with, you know, that multi-billion-dollar-a-year economy that's off the books, okay? So when we look at this country, we know that race is not something that's behind us. So how do we explain a black president? How do we explain people in middle America who may have had misconceptions about people of African ancestry voting for Barack Obama? And I'm quite sure if any of you have read anything that I've written on this subject in the past, you know what the answer is. Barack Obama is not an African-American. I mean, he's an African that was born in an American state, Hawaii. But actually, Barack Obama has more in common with most folks in this room than he has with me. You know, and this could be seen in a question that was put to Barack Obama by one of these right-wing journalists, and they said, you know, you're being accused of being because you're black, that you've got a black agenda, you know, that this was after the Wright issue, during the Wright, you know, the Reverend Wright, Bruhaha. And he was asked, well, can you, do you still support Reverend Wright in his extreme statements? He said, I could no more deny Reverend Wright than I could, you know, deny the black community. But I'm not limited by being black. That's what he said. He didn't say the opposite. He didn't say, I have a white mother, I was raised in a white family, in a white community, I went to a predominantly white school, I had a predominantly elite white education, you know, but I'm not, you know, defined by that. I'm not confined to that. He didn't say that. He said the opposite. He was appealing to white folks in America, saying, look, you don't have to worry about me waking up in the morning with a flashback to the plantation, because I was never on the plantation. You know, I'm not going to get a flashback and call, you know, the 1st Air Force in to fire bomb Alabama or the capital of Mississippi, you know, that has to fly a Confederate flag, because I don't have that in my DNA. And he doesn't have that. Michelle has it, but we didn't vote for Michelle. My point is, white America didn't vote for an African American. They didn't vote for someone that had the history and the legacy of being underclass and second-class citizens in a country for generations. His family did not come from the plantation. They were not descendants of slaves. In fact, his father was a colonial. Okay? So my point is that white folks don't even consider the obvious. This guy got more in common with y'all than he does with us. I mean, after all, he was raised by his white family.
All of y'all were raised by white families. I wasn't raised by a white family. He got more in common with you.
I mean, this is just basic logic, but this is a logic that flies in the face of the historical moment. And the historical moment is basically this, that since 1945, the United States has been, and now it is, the supreme military and political power on the planet. And it has manipulated every international institution to support its policies and its initiatives and its strategic interests. We know from the founding of the United Nations, we know why the United Nations was founded, despite all of the glorious rhetoric about wars being, you know, more humane and no more war. The United Nations, for the first 10 years of its existence, carried out what? U.S. foreign policy. Korea, South Vietnam, Indonesia, Eastern Europe, every interest that the United States had, the UN intervened in its behalf. The Security Council, the most undemocratic institution on the planet, is dominated by the former imperialist power, which tells you that globalization is nothing but New Age imperialism. It's a new form of imperialism because it's built upon the old structures and institutions that came out of World War II, which were decidedly imperialist. What was the first objective of the victors of World War II? To recoup the territories of their former imperial glory. The French wanted Indochina back, couldn't get it. Of course, you know, forget the Italians. They bugged out in the middle of the war, so they definitely wasn't getting anything back. You know, the British wanted to reconstitute its empire, went through a whole big thing with India, recognizing, you know, I mean, this whole history. And the reason why I'm throwing out all these historical things is for you to understand that all of these things have come to this moment in time. All of these forces have come to this point in time. They talk about the class of civilizations between Islam and the West, and then you have one group of Muslims over here telling you that Islam is a religion of peace. We share the same ancestors, which is a lie. It's not true. But without getting into the theological basis of it, we share the same ancestors in terms of Abraham, which the Muslims call Ibrahim. We share the same ancestors, blah, 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 blah. You know, and therefore, Muslims should be someone that you shouldn't fear. They're just like you. They get up in the morning. They want the best for their children, like Muslims came from another planet. You know, they came from the planet Mongo. And you know, we don't want what's good for us. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like when white folks used to say, you people. They used to say, you people. You people? You know, what do you people want? And I used to hear that all the time. You know. And the person that was saying it was not necessarily a mean-spirited person or someone that was really just an out and out, you know, racist. In their ignorance, they saw themselves as separate from you. And this is what we're looking at now when we look at Palestine, when we look at the Palestinian issue. We look at what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Iraq, and what's happening in Afghanistan as separate from us in certain respects. I mean, we're concerned with the mortgage, right? We're concerned with paying our bills. We're concerned with getting our children a decent education. We're concerned with, you know, being able to walk the street safely in the evening. We're concerned with jobs. We're concerned with our environment. We're concerned with all these issues, but all of these issues are directly connected to what's happening in Palestine. How is it? I'll give you just a simple example. The United States government subsidizes the Israeli economy to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a month. Not a day, not a year, a month. Hundreds of millions. This is non-military aid. Non-military. But yet and still, that same government is cutting back in development of schools in our communities. They don't have the money for schools. They don't have the money to improve our infrastructure. They don't have the money to move technology into the ghetto. I mean, we're in a digital divide, right, in every urban area that we live in. On one side of the tracks where white folks live with money, there's fiber optics, there's internet cafes, and there's wireless, you know, spaces. And in the side where the black community is, people are still using dial-up. Black folks are still using dial-up. Do you remember dial-up? Anybody remember dial-up? Sitting there going to get dinner while the computer loads? Okay, let me go get a drink. You know, we're still on dial-up. They don't move to files and fiber optics and all of this stuff, right? So there's a digital divide. In terms of environmental racism, we see where that's at. We see that this whole issue in Somalia, I mean, we could get into that, in the west, the east coast of Africa. No one has talked about toxic dumping and all of these things that the Western nations have been doing in the third world and in Africa until people in the third world starts hijacking the ships. When they start hijacking the ships, then you see takedown of pirates in the Somalia. You know, and they talk about how, you know, special forces have been training for this moment in time, and they rescued the crew from this hijack. You know, it's a big hero story. It's going to be a movie with Arnold or somebody. Arnold's not acting no more, is he? It's going to be a movie with one of them guys. It's probably going to be the next governor of California. And so I'm saying that there is a direct connection with our government spending money on wars, spending money on building infrastructures abroad that it cannot sustain and build at home. I mean, we have a population in the United States that's opposed to universal health care. I mean, how dumb can you get? You really got to be stupid to go for that one. It's telling you, you're better off with insurance company. Trust me. Trust you? The insurance company? Weren't you the guys that just got us into this mess? Trust AIG? We should trust AIG? Huh? Should we? We should trust Prudential? Trust me? So now the guys said, well, you know, I mean, they had I don't know if y'all saw the special on TV, but yeah, this guy actually sit up and said that it was un-American for him to not be able to choose who his health provider was. It was un-American. He was a capitalist. He felt that, and then they asked him, so are you working now? He says, well, I'm not working now, which is true. And if I don't get a job within the next 90 days, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have this condition here, some type of physical condition, and they won't give you treatment for it. And here's a guy that's explaining to us, in one breath, how he's about to die because he doesn't have health insurance and a job, and in the other breath, telling him that's his right to die that way as an American. Yeah. And you know, the homeboy is scrambled up. Where is this problem? And you have to understand that if you sat down in a room with the average person that believes socialism is something negative and actually sat down with them and asked them, what is socialism to them? You would be shocked by what they would say. We know that the Russians gave socialism a good idea, a bad name. We know that. Okay, they gave a good idea, a bad name. You got to admit that. Okay, Stalin, Khrushchev, you know, people, you know, society taking care of the ill, taking care of the elderly, you know, providing reason. All these principles. principles of socialism are good ideas. It's just these knuckleheads gave it a bad rap. So now you have people in the United States saying that Obama's a socialist. I mean, come on. I mean, Obama's a socialist.
Oh, you wish,
right? You know, he's a socialist.
I mean,
and you say, how could somebody, you know, how could anybody say that? I mean, here's a man that was groomed, and this was my point. He was groomed for this historical moment. I don't think anybody in the world would have listened to another George Bush lookalike. Nobody in the world since 1945 to now, we have had white men, mainly white men, tell the world what was best for them. We have had males, white, black, Arab, and everybody, creating wars, waging wars for empire, for power, for territory, on all of these things. But the United States has come forward now with a black man as president at the point in time when the empire is in dire straits. But because no one else can save the empire, don't think that Obama is not doing his job. He is doing an excellent job. It's just not for us. He is doing the job that he was groomed for, and he's doing a wonderful job. And y'all should give him a round of applause for doing this job. Because the job that he is doing is saving the empire from itself. Because despite U.S. policies, and you all know here that his policies internationally has not deviated one iota from the Bush administration. Not one. Just in terms of rhetoric and game it has. But it's the same old policy. Whether it's in relationship to Iran, whether it's in relationship to Palestine and the Middle East, whether it's in relationship to the only thing that he's almost different from is the certain domestic issues like health care. He's the only president that brought it this far. And I mean, and all of us can agree that it's just about washed up. The type of health care programs that we thought he would bring into existence is not happening. You know? But he's tried in that respect. Okay? But that's about it. So the empire is in dire straits. And the world economy, the U.S. use of the military, the U.S. cannot maintain 2 and 3 wars with a volunteer army. So what does it do? Privatize war. Do you know we have over 180,000 private contractors working abroad in behalf of the U.S. military? In Iraq alone, when they count the casualty figures and they count the number of personnel that's on the ground, they do not count contractors. Okay? So privatization of the military and privatization of what at home go hand in hand. Criminal law enforcement. Privatization of prisons. The use of corporations to carry out functions of the state that used to be functions of the state. We've seen this beginning with Katrina. We've seen this with Blackwater in New Orleans when the police abandoned the people, and we'll see it again as catastrophes arise. The major contractors in building prisons abroad is Brown and Root. They build everything. They build military bases, they build prisons, they build facilities for airport facilities, they build harbor facilities. This is one company, Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton. And I think so your homeboy, one of your vice presidents, used to be involved. What's his name?
Cheney.
Yeah, that guy. That guy. So I'm saying that there is a direct connection between the economy of empire and domestic and foreign policy. It's a direct connection. It's nothing indirect. When we look at the repression that's being carried out against Muslims here, against philanthropic organizations, Islamic organizations who are doing charity work, here in the United States, they've had their property seized, their members indicted and arrested. But at the same time the United States is doing this to philanthropic organizations, it has militarized foreign aid abroad. There's no distinction between the State Department's USAID program in Afghanistan and the Defense Department's development program. In fact, the Defense Department controls, from what I've read, over 65% of the foreign aid budget. The Defense Department. So foreign aid workers are seen now as adjuncts of the military. So they're no longer neutral, they're no longer safe, they can be no longer trusted. And it's the same thing in our community. What is happening in our community? All of our politicians, all of our political leaders, and I don't really have any here.
We do.
Oh, you have some? Yeah. Oh, well, is that you, my friend? So all of our politicians and most of our political leaders don't represent their constituency. They don't represent their community. They represent the corporate interest that finances their campaigns and that makes their candidacy possible. This is where the money comes from. This is where the influence comes from. And when we look at the black community, especially like in the Northeast, we see the inordinate influence of Zionist organizations and Zionist institutions in supporting our own political leaders. So now we have a point, we have come to the point, where if we go over the record of the black the black congressional caucus, if we go over their voting record on the issue of Palestine, whenever they have an opportunity to vote on that issue, on international issues in the Middle East, they have consistently voted in behalf of Israel and in behalf of AIPAC and the Zionist lobby. They have never opposed. Only few congresspersons have opposed them, and most of them, while it looks like Cynthia McKinney. So what do we have here? We have in this country a false sense of democracy. We have democratic fascism in this country when you actually think about it, because fascism is the what? The marriage of the corporate state, the marriage of the corporations and the economy of the elite with the state. And if you can't get more married than the corporate state in America, the corporations in the states are like this. We have black politicians right here in our country who are fervent advocates for the state of Israel, and they won't advocate for one black political prisoner in this country. They won't advocate for one grand jury resistor in this country. If you walked up to them and say, look, what's your position on Umair Abu-Jamal, they'll run straight across the room. And they might tell you to your face, well, we support the brother, and so and so and so, but would they put a resolution on that floor for Umair? Hell no! And the reason why is because they're not really opposed to the death penalty, and Umair has become the international symbol in opposition to the death penalty. He has become a symbol. I mean, I travel to the Middle East, and traveled to Turkey, and traveled all over Africa. And they asked me, what's happening with Umair Abu-Jamal? But you haven't got a black politician in the United States to sit up in the Senate and say one mumbling word about the death penalty of Umair Abu-Jamal.
Thank you.
Not one. You have the email of a large community in the United States sitting up in Colorado in prison, locked down 23 hours a day for the murder of a police officer that was patently a settler, which is absolutely no evidence on. He doesn't even have a federal conviction, but he's in a federal penitentiary. He's in the United States domestic version of Guantanamo, right there in Colorado. And that's Imam Jamil Alameen. Many of us know him as H-Rap Brown. The recent murder of Iman Lukman, who was a follower of Imam Alameen in Detroit. I know many of you heard about that murder of this Imam in Detroit. What was the strategy of the United States government and the FBI when they murdered this man? This man was shot over 21 times. What was their strategy? The strategy was the exact same strategy they used against the Black Panther Party. Do you remember the murder of Fred Hampton?
Yes.
When they murdered Fred Hampton, what did they say? They went to serve a legal warrant on these crazy Panthers, and they started shooting at him through the door. And they returned the fire, and they killed this man. Okay? Of course, back then, they didn't have major case squad, you know, crime scene, CSI, and all of that stuff to run up and, you know, wrap the yellow tape around the crime scene and put the bodies up, outline the chalk right away. So the Panthers went into the building and opened it up to the press and the public. immediately after the assault. And the people came and saw that all the bullets were going into the house. None of them were coming out. So it belied the story of the FBI. They had to backstep and say, well, you know, it wasn't like that. They started lying. And to this day, the family has never gotten justice. But the point is this, that the people that set up Fred Hampton was an FBI informant. The plans were given to the state. The state then took the plans and raided the house and murdered Fred Hampton in his sleep after he was drugged. Because, you know, the autopsy showed that he was drugged. Okay? They murdered him in his sleep. And they said that basically, you know, well, we can murder Black Panther because, you know, they're crazy and they're about guns and they don't like cops. And so it's okay to murder them. That's basically what was being said. And that's the exact same thing that was being said about Imam Bukhari. They fabricated some story about how he was advocating for the establishment of an Islamic state in America. Come on, man. That's what they say on NFL Today. Come on, man. I mean, there's not a Muslim in America. There's not a sane Muslim in America who is talking about an Islamic state of North America. That's not happening. Okay? That's like a non-starter. So where did the press come up with this? They said, well, his followers talked about belonging to the Ummah. Every Muslim on the planet belongs to the Ummah. You see? The point here is that the reason why this man was murdered is because he represented a segment of Islam in this country is violently opposed to and afraid of. And that is the 35% of this population who are African American. Because the history of African America, of Africans in America, is a history of racist repression, is a history of genocide, is a history of murder, is a history of injustice. And so they fear Black folks. I mean, look at all of the FBI documents throughout, from COINTELPRO up until now. What do they talk about? Homegrown terrorists, indigenous revolutionaries. Black folks are like the house version of Osama bin Laden. We like the in-house version. You know, we might rise up and get down with any revolutionary rhetoric or any revolutionary program that talks about offering white folks. So we just like knuckleheads sitting around waiting for a plan from somebody. Okay? We don't have a mind of our own, a history of our own, a history of struggle of our own. We have a history of struggle in this country. And that history of struggle is not just marching for voting rights. It's not just trying to get on the ballot. That history of struggle has changed the face of this nation. When most left organizations were homophobic, were hating on gay people, it was the Black Panther Party that put out a resolution talking about gay rights and homosexual rights in this country. The Black Panther Party. That's right, really. Really. Go look at it on this Black Panther Party. And this was in 1968. 1968. When they were talking about the war in Vietnam, it was the Black Panther Party who broke down the analysis of U.S. imperialism and supported the French and everything and said that we would send volunteers to fight on the side of the NLF. It was the Black Panther Party. When our children were going to school and weren't being fed and couldn't get no meals in the school, it was the Black Panther Party that started the breakfast program and started feeding children. Today, in school, lunch programs is normal. Everybody gets to eat. In fact, the state gives subsidies to families so that they can feed their children. There's a whole bureaucracy based upon that. Now, when you look at Black History Month, when you go into the month of October in every school in this country, see if you find one historical mention that the Black Panther Party started food programs in school. They got the day that Peanuts became a cartoon. Hey, my son's program celebrations, great days in history. Peanuts was a cartoon on this day in 1931. Do they have on this day in October the Black Panther Party founded the breakfast program? Huh? And you know why they don't? Because of the Black folks who are administering the schools. That's why. The school I'm talking about is a Black school. The administrators are Black. They're young African-American administrators, teachers, and whatever. And what's on the Board of Education holidays to celebrate? Everything is white.
everything that has nothing to do with, oh, of course, it's Louis Armstrong's birthday. He played the trumpet. Can't get past Martin, he was a dreamer. Can't get past Obama, he raised the most money any black man raised for a campaign. All that stuff is in there. But is there one mention of that? Is there one resolution by city council? Councilman placed on that? And here you got folks in the Congress, like Bobby Rush, who were members of the Black Panther Party. And if you was to walk up to Bobby Rush today and say, and I know him personally, I would say, Bobby, you know, we need some help around this issue with the media. You know what he'll tell me? My plate is full, brother. I can't really deal with that. That's what you're telling me. So why should I talk to somebody like a Bobby Rush? What's the point? You see? So my point here is that in America, we have come to the point where democracy is an oxymoron. It's a useless term. It can mean anything and it means absolutely nothing. You do not have a system where we can develop a third party or even a loyal opposition. It's not like Europe. You know, in Europe, when one party wins, it usually has to win by a certain percentage of the votes. And if it doesn't win by that percentage of the votes, it has to form a coalition with the opposition. And so in Europe, you have communist parties and leftist parties who are used to sharing power, who have been involved in the power process, who may have set up shadow governments, so that when the media tells a story, it has to go to the opposition to get this side of the story. That's not happening here in America. In America, it's winner take all. Winner take all. So if 45 or 55 or 60% of the population vote, and 90% of and 50 or 40 or 60% of that population votes for one candidate, the other 40% forget about it. You ain't got no, you know, unless homeboys that get power decide to put you on the in the cabinet or put you on the, you know, give you a job. Otherwise, forget about it. So you have a situation in this country where direct vote is not happening. And we know this from the disenfranchisement of millions of African Americans during the last two campaigns. Black folks was disenfranchised. And how many black politicians pressed the issue? How many of them filed a lawsuit? There was only a certain group of black politicians that pressed that issue until they became totally irrelevant. It was like, oh man, who are these people? They're crazy. You know, it's all over. The Supreme Court appointed the president. You know, live with it. Let's move on. You see? So we've had these experiences. We've had these experiences where we have had third world banana republic elections in this country and everybody thought it was democracy. So what I'm trying to point out here is that what we really have to try to focus on now is how can we build those networks and those relationships that begin to empower people on a very basic level. And I think one of the key issues right now, of course, is the issue of political detainees. Because this goes to the heart of our civil and human rights. What they have done in Guantanamo, in the name of America, they have been doing to black people in prison in this country for years. There is not one technique. There is not one technique that they have started in Guantanamo that they didn't do to us. When I was in prison, it was common to go to the isolation units and have them turn up the heat in the summer and close the windows until you sweat and you have to walk around in your cell almost naked. And in the winter, they'll open the windows and turn the heat off. This is they do this in Unit 14 up in Clinton Prison. You don't have to go all the way to Guantanamo or read a report from a prison, from a background air base to see that. Waterboarding? Waterboarding? Do you know in New York State Prison, they used to hose you down in your cell and open up the windows in the winter so that you would freeze? This is nothing new. Forced haircuts, forced feeding, beatings. If you didn't know how to fight naked upstate New York, you didn't know how to fight because you had to fight buck naked. So where am I getting all of these things from? Am I making this all up in my mind? They just invented this when the war on terror started? No. They've been implementing this on African people in the United States since the first black man landed in this country. And you have black leaders that actually sit up on TV and get up in the Congress and talk about the policies of this government, the policies of this government were rational and didn't have a historical basis.
This is something that Cheney and Bush just started. Nixon ain't had nothing to do with it. The major architect of rendition was not Bush and Cheney. It was the present representative of the United States to the United Nations, Miss Rice. That's who began the rendition process in East Africa. And as we speak right now, no matter what these crackers say in government, they are still running rendition camps in Kenya, they are still running rendition camps in Eastern Europe and in East Africa. They have surrogates like the Ethiopians, and they have surrogate powers like the Kenyans who are doing their dirty work for them. And we have black leaders. I mean, I've worked with refugees in Africa from Liberia, from Sierra Leone, and from Congo. And these, the individuals who control these struggles, who are controlling blood diamonds, are the same ones that the black caucus, right here in this country, used to sit up and fet in Washington, D.C. The same individuals talking about they were progressives in Africa when they were pieces of shit in Africa. So what I'm trying to say to you is that we have disingenuous and misleaders in the black community here who vote against our interests internationally and then turn around and talk to us about reform and urban agendas. There is a connection between U.S. domestic policy and U.S. foreign policy. Obama can talk about urban institutions being and urban infrastructures being renovated. That's one thing to talk about. But how do you reconcile renovating these institutions when all of the money that should go to renovate these institutions are supporting reactionary foreign policies? So we have to understand right here that what we're dealing with is increasingly as the empire begins to collapse, begins to become dysfunctional, that it's the networks that we create in our communities that will help us survive. We see that in Katrina. You know, before Katrina, I did a speaking tour in the United States. In fact, I was in the United States when Katrina happened, and I live in Africa. And the thing I was talking about then was the necessity for a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency. I said, you know, whenever we look at a tragedy or disaster in Africa, it's always white folks who are coming forth to tell us, you know, what's happening. It's, you know, Doctors Without Borders, you know, psychologists without couches, you know. And all of these different, you know, and believe me, the work that these people are doing is very good work. A lot of them are doing invaluable work. I mean, I've been up into these places, man, you know, where people don't have access to medical care. And so, you know, I'm not making fun or ridiculing the intentions of the people who are involved in these types of programs. So I'm not ridiculing that, but the point is that African Americans, who control over $60 billion a year in disposable income, are absent. And this is the continent of the origin. They're absent, completely absent. When Haiti jumped off, where are we sending the money to? The Red Cross, Salvation Army, the State Department. We don't have no agency of our own. Forget the black community. The left, the progressive community, doesn't have no agency on this. So, without these types of instruments, without these types of networks, what can we achieve? What can we accomplish? Not much. We are living in a country where winners take all. A third party is not possible. Or if a third party is possible, and let me give you this caveat because I think this is happening now. If a third party is possible, it would be imagination from the right. And that's what we see happening with this Tea Party. If a third party evolves in the United States, it would be imagination from the right because you have the epitome of white folks' fear. A black man, a nigger with his finger on the trigger. So, I mean, although they created this man they created this political entity that we know as Barack Obama to get them through this particular crucial phase of the empire. Don't think that they won't blame him if it doesn't work. It would be our fault. We were too concerned with race. Now, you know Obama hasn't mentioned race since he's been in office. And it's not a coincidence that most black politicians who are in Congress haven't mentioned race, neither, since he's been in office. It's like he got a pass, you see. So when we talk about this, we have to really understand that what we have developed in this country is, first of all, democratic fascism, which passes for democracy. We have racial politics in which now the keepers of the castle, the ones who have made a living off of race politics, you know, we have a whole bunch of race, we have had black leaders who made a living off of race politics. I mean, that's been their thing. They got paid that way. You know, this has been their sole claim to fame. This is how they got their living. And now that these individuals are being sort of like retired, semi-retired, you know, they have to fend for themselves. They have to develop programs and ideas and struggles. This is why you see Barack Obama can go to the NAACP and give a speech to black men about how they need to be more responsive. Check that out. He's going to give his head. He's going to lecture black folks how they should be more responsible for their children. You have black leaders going on television talking about violence in the black community and in the streets amongst our youth. It's basically their fault. They're the reason why, you know, there's violence in the community. They're the reasons why. We're not taking time to educate our children. We're not taking time to go and be hands-on in our community and take care of our children. All the mayhem in the world is not being caused by black kids. Why don't white folks educate their children? Why don't they take responsibility for their children? All the Columbines and all of these crazy murders and all of these serial killers running around here. Very few of them. So we got some dysfunctional white families up in this piece, too. How come we don't lecture white folks about how they need to be more responsible? Seeing he has more in common with them than he does with black folks. No, he doesn't do that because the onus for oppression is always put on the oppressed. The onus for being backwards is always put on the people who can't go forward. That's the onus. And that's not to say that we're not responsible for what we do. But information is intelligence, and in this day and age, there's more people that want to know less than there are people that want to know more. Because once you know something, you're responsible for what you know. You see? That's why you see that at the end of World War II, what did Eisenhower and the generals do to all those people that lived near the concentration camps? He walked them through the concentration camps to show them what was going on right next to this. And then what were they going to say? Over all the smoke that was coming up, it did smell kind of funny. Well, we didn't know they were murdering people down the road. Ignorance was what? Bliss. Now what you don't know will get your ass killed. It's no longer bliss. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Iraq. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Palestine. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Somalia. You can't say that no more. You go on the internet, man, you get information overload. So you can't say the ignorance that you don't know. What you're saying now is that you know and you don't care. What you know doesn't translate into actions. And that's the disconnect. What we know, we are responsible for. If we know that something is wrong, we are responsible to right it. Now, some of us may not have the courage. Some of us may not have the physical capacity or whatever to get out into the street and demonstrate, or they may not be that articulate to articulate a point, you know. But we all can do something, and we all can make a contribution to those who can do something. And I think that one of the first things that we have to really see is that it's our networks that will make a difference, that will protect us in catastrophe. We have to have readiness networks. We have to be able to have our own clinics in our community. The churches in our community should be repositories of survival programs. We should be able to store survival gear there. What would happen if tomorrow, if all electricity went off in Minneapolis and never came back on? What would you do? Wait for Homeland Security? FEMA? Still waiting for FEMA in New Orleans. What would you do? Seriously, what would you do? We don't know what we would do with the elderly in the projects. If somebody lives on the 16th floor, how would we get them downstairs? How would the old people get something to eat? How would we get them to some places, some shelters? What are we going to do with our youth? What are they going to do? The schools are closed. What are we going to do? Think about that. The lights go off and don't come back on. Just think about that. That's a scary thought.
You have to rely on the fire department. The fire department to say, okay, these are good guys, man. And I give firemen their props because they go run. Anybody that runs into a fire to save another human being deserves my praise. You know, whatever their politics are. But they got families too. Don't think they're going to be so concerned about my family, they're not going to go look out for theirs. Where did the police go in New Orleans? They want to look out for their family. They didn't care. I mean, look, defend and protect? Yeah, right over here. You see? What did we have? Nothing. What are the Crips and the Bloods and all these gang bangers doing in our community? If anybody knew the history of these gangs, the sociological and political history of these gangs, you'd be shocked. These gangs didn't start out slinging drugs and thugging and living a thug life. They didn't start out that way. They were made into that by a system that refused to deal with what they were talking about. It's the same system. I mean, how many of you remember when, what was the sister's name from California? This was years ago. She was coming out and she was a congressperson. And she was burning CDs. And rap DVDs. She was burning them, talking about rap music was negative, rap music was misogynist, rap music was the music of the devil, and all this other stuff. Now, when's the last time you've seen people burning stuff? Last time I saw that was on a documentary on the military channel, and it was showing how the Nazis was burning books. That was a prelude to what we know as the most. It's one of the most difficult times in human history. But this woman was out there burning all of these discs and all of these. Now look at hip-hop. Now look at gangster rap. Now look at misogyny. Did it diminish because of her actions? Did she and those black politicians who were so negative about rap music, did that change the lucrative nature of the culture? Did that change it?
No.
What happened to certain forces who were not necessarily sympathetic to the community that these artists came from, took that music, glamorized it, publicized it, produced it, distributed it, made sure it got rotation on the radio, so every 5 minutes you hear somebody holding their groin or their crouch talking about hold this and hold that. Homegirl's CD burning didn't work, but it was good for politics. It was good for her. It was good for the Negro politicians who didn't have anything else better to do. They weren't out there burning. They weren't out there burning their donation card to AIPAC. They weren't burning that. You see, instead of engaging those black youth and moving that away from that paradigm of corporate control and negativity, they condemned it and moved it right into the camp. So now, all of those guys that were talking all of that slick cop killer stuff, they all play cops on the television. They're all cops. All cops. If they're not cops, they're the leader of some gang of mutants, you understand, who eat human flesh or something. But they all play cops. Ice-T, Ice-Cube, Iceberg, they all play cops. So, what I'm getting at is, we have had, over the years, black leaders who have come forward, seemingly on a progressive note, who are in fact reactionary, and who are in fact leading the way for reactionary control of our community. And now in our community today, we still don't control anything. We've had, in Harlem, for instance, we've had the Harlem Chamber of Commerce, Charlie Rangel, and all of these Negroes get together in Harlem and talk about how, you know, we have to open up Harlem to gentrification, and we open it up to businesses, and now we got Body Shop, we got all of the major corporations on 125th Street, all of the little small entrepreneurs, the guys that was out there selling t-shirts and all that stuff, they're gone. Body Shop and all of them are there, the real estate values have gone up, and now there's no black person in Harlem that can afford an apartment no more. You have all of these boutiques in Harlem selling upscale stuff that you find down in Soho, and nobody in Harlem is buying that. Where's their clientele at? And this is the result of the Charlie Rangels in our leadership. Yeah, you can tell that to Charlie when you see him again. It's the result of these Negroes. They're the ones that led us down this path of prosperity. Okay?
So what I'm saying to you, a lot of times we think that because someone stands up amongst us, like Obama, and makes these promises about how we can move together as a nation and do A, B, C, and D, okay? And then when he becomes president, he bails out the banks, he bails out the insurance companies, he bails out everybody, the car industry. And then when it comes to you and me, it's like, hey, you know what? We got to rethink this tax rebate. Well, you didn't rethink that crap when you was bailing out. And now, you know, the banks are back in the black again. They're getting, you know, $10 million parachutes. They're back at it again. No shame. I mean, it's so embarrassing that the president got to come out and chastise. Damn, man, could y'all do this undercover or something? Keep this under wraps. Why y'all got to come out and do it like this? After I gave you all this money. After he done printed all this money. And remember, he printed it. He printed it. Printed it, as in print on paper, fiat capital. And there's never been a historical moment in which fiat capital has ever, ever not collapsed. Now, all this money he done printed, somebody got to pay to the piper. Because if you got these billions and billions of dollars in notes, and you don't have absolute, I mean, the Chinese got more U.S. dollars than we got. If you print all of this money, what happens after you print all of this money? What do they call it?
Inflation.
So what's the next phase we're going to go through? But it's going to have a different name. You know? And you're going to have Greenspan talking about it. I didn't see that. I really thought that if we stimulated the... This is Greenspan. I mean, anybody else... I mean, you know, if he was in Syria, they would have put him on trial and shot him. They would have said he sabotaged the government. He sabotaged the economy. You know? Here we got all these experts that know absolutely jack doo-doo about what they're doing. But we think they're all experts. It's like we think the CIA knows everything. You know? Anytime when people rise up in Iran... It's the CIA. The CIA did it. The CIA made them do it. The CIA did this. The CIA did it. Everybody thinks white folks are so sharp that they on top of everything everywhere, and people ain't got a mind of their own. When you look at the situation that we're in, we are in the situation precisely because the white boys sitting up in Washington are stupid. They're clueless. Look at Iran. What happened with Iran? You had an old man take over from who? The Shah, and they slept. They all slept. They didn't even know this was going to happen. They didn't think it was going to happen like that. Here was a person that they had set up in a region to be their surrogate power. All of his military gear, all of his military equipment, all of that stuff that he had, the United States and the West had given it to him. He created this police state. And in the blink of an eye, an old man with audio tapes overthrew it. And he said, "Why did that happen?" But the point is that this was the first time in modern history that an ideology other than Marxism or Leninism or secular ideology